Welcome to Season 2 of The Great Humbling. My name's Dugald Hine. I'm a writer and co-founder of a school called Home. Through the strange spring of 2020, I kept a weekly appointment with the futurist Ed Gillespie, where we would puzzle our way through the stories taking shape around the pandemic and how all this fits into a longer arc of social, political, and ecological crisis. We called these conversations The Great Humbling because we started from a sense that this is a time of being humbled, brought down to earth, and we wanted to ask what happens if we approach the moment we're in on those terms. Now we're back for a second season, where each week we'll be taking a state of mind that seems to be part of the mix of being alive just now. So this is The Great Humbling Season 2, Altered States. States of being, states of consciousness, and of course, the literal alteration of our nation states. Thanks for listening. Here we are. It's September. I don't know how it is in London, but up here in Sweden, the leaves are changing colour. Outside the window, as I speak, the rumour of autumn is spreading, and we're back. How are you doing, Ed?
Well, it's Indian summer here in South London. 28 balmy degrees today, although there is a proper autumnal chill of an evening that reminds you that the season is turning. But in a way, I love that contrast of daytime heat and cool nights, because it's literally a refreshing change from the breathless suffocation of the city in summer as that concrete radiates its absorbed warmth all night. So bring on the season of mists and mellow fruitfulness, as Keats said.
Ah, yes, here we go. Well, I mean, I guess the place to start from is just, what does it mean to be talking about these things this autumn? We're at a different stage of the pandemic. You know, there's rising infection rates in lots of countries and renewed restrictions. But I think we're also starting to see the long-term decisions that people are making at a personal and household level that will add up to some of the major changes that we'll see when we look back on this whole COVID-19 event. We've got the political context of this autumn. We're going to be recording over the next 8 weeks. So by the time we get to our final episode, there will have been an election in the United States. Whether there will be an election result, we'll see. But I guess that's also going to feed into what it means to be talking about the humbling, talking about the times we're living in as a time of humbling this autumn. And then we've had Extinction Rebellion back on the streets of London and elsewhere over the last couple of weeks. We've got, you know, the West Coast of the US wreathed in smoke in this extraordinary fire season. So I guess all of that, maybe what we'll be trying to do over the next 8 weeks, is puzzle our way through the interconnections, not even at the level of causality, but just the way in which these things that we're living through come together and give us clues to the nature of the times in which we find ourselves. And Ed, you had this idea of a frame for the new season, Altered States. Do you want to just talk us into that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the quote that's been resonating with me from the fires in the West Coast that you just mentioned are saying, this isn't California's worst year in the last 100. It's California's best year in the next 1,000. When I read that and it was doing the rounds on Twitter, it was like, oof. But the thinking behind the idea of altered states was really around the layers of meaning, the idea of altered states of being, as well as the diversity of stories that are attempting to encapsulate these times, as we explored in series one, but also the diversity of experiences, which which flagged some of the existing inequalities that COVID and climate have been, both been flushing out. And of course, the altered states of consciousness that are calling us to attention. Really, it's also about the literal sense that our nations are being changed by this pandemic experience and the not so creeping climate crisis. And their authority and ability to protect us is questioned by challenges that do not see, let alone respect, borders. So it's really those multiple layers of meaning around altered states. And the first episode, we're going to call State of Alert, which it feels like we've actually been in for many months now, and we'll get into that shortly. But we have this tradition where we always start by asking each other, what have you been reading that got you thinking? So where has your muse been taking you, Dougald?
Oh, wow. Well, it's a bit different when you ask that question after a whole summer. There's been loads of things. But I want to home in on this debate that went on over the summer, mostly on open democracy. It started with a critique of Jem Bendel's deep adaptation paper. And I mean, it got quite messy. I think, you know, the whole deep adaptation thing itself is messy. And I have a hunch we'll come back to that in a future episode. But out of that whole debate, the piece that I want to highlight is a response that came from the Gesturing Towards Decolonial Futures Collective, that was published under the title Preparing for the End of the World as We Know It. Now, I would have mentioned Decolonial Futures more than once in series one, because Vanessa Andriotti, who's the person I know best from within the collective, is one of the people who I find it really helpful to think with. And in this piece, they talk about how this whole Western conversation about collapse, particularly in relation to climate change, how this looks from the perspective of the indigenous thinkers and knowledge keepers who are part of their collective. How the aversion to talk about collapse that you see in some of the reactions to something like deep adaptation reminds them of the avoidance of death and dying that they see as peculiar to Western cultures. How they see people recoiling from these conversations out of a desire to, as they put it, to maintain a sense of hope in the futurity and continuity of the existing system. And I felt like that named something that often isn't named clearly. Okay, when we're talking about hope, what is it that we're being asked to have hope in? To the extent that our hope is in the futurity and continuity of the existing system, I'm not sure that is a kind of hope worth having, which is not to underestimate the extent to which things could get worse as the existing systems fall apart. Now, in that piece, they introduce many different indigenous voices from different parts of the world. And I mean, the article's full of links, so you can go there, you'll get a whole reading list, which I'd really recommend. But one of the recurring themes is the need to, and again, I'm quoting from it, to challenge the presumed desirability of the continuity of modern colonial modes of existence. Now, they're writing about climate change and the way that the response to it ends up getting framed as the need to save the world as we know it. And they're pointing out that the world as we know it just now was built on the destruction of the worlds and ways of knowing of so many cultures and communities around the world. And also that there are, you know, so many people around the world who are still there with what they've been able to bring with them of their cultures and communities through this experience of destruction. But they also put the arguments they're making in the context of COVID-19. And they use that line that I quoted at the end of the last episode of season one, the Inuit poet Takrillik Partridge, asking us to consider that this pandemic is only the warning shots of a major storm humanity will need to weather together. So yeah, I've been thinking a lot about that phrase, about the warning shots and how it might help us make sense of the times around and ahead of us. How about you, Ed? What have you been reading?
Well, just when you're talking about you know, that idea of hope and maintaining a sense of hope in the futurity and continuity of the existing system. I do quite like one of the deep adaptation words, the kind of neologism of hopium, which is a sort of indicative quality of that type of hope. But I mean, like you, I mean, enormous amounts of inspiration and provocation has been digested and reflected on over the summer. But we did a launch last week for the Guide to Eco-Anxiety by psychoanalyst Anushka Gross. I wrote the foreword for, and that theme you just highlighted was actually a really strong one during that conversation. Because in the book, Anushka highlights the trauma of the American Indians in witnessing the destruction of not only their ecology, but their culture and their way of life. It's a bit like Alexander von Humboldt, you know, who is credited with the invention of nature, was arguably effectively white-splaining ecology to indigenous cultures, you know, something that they intuitively understood and knew. But also that our own culture faces similar breakdowns. I'm currently reading Nick Hayes, who's a wonderful writer and illustrator, who also did the cover of my book, Only Planet, and his new book, Trespass, Crossing the Lines That Divide Us, which is an absolutely stunning first-hand exploration of the notion of property, in which each chapter adopts an animal icon and a specific act of trespass that Nick undertakes onto private property in an adventure into land rights, the nature of the commons, and how the Enclosures Act served to destroy much of our own access, rights to, and cultural relationship with our land here in the UK. So a lot of digestion on similar themes, actually. And then, as always, there's Martin Shaw, whose latest book, and my God, that man is prolific at the moment. He is in one extraordinary state of flow. But his new book, Wolfaland, which is based on a 101-day wilderness rite of passage where he visited the same Dartmoor forest daily to receive its message. And it's an absolutely gripping and poetic ride through a wolf time full of sharp claws, raised hackles and bared teeth and stories. And I'm just going to read a short section of what he was saying about the stories that he's experiencing. He goes, some stories are smooth and self-sufficient, others needy, requiring endless rounds of reassuring. Others are built for the roar of the tavern, some little scrappy puffs of magic that don't stay for long and refuse to learn your name. Some stories you couldn't hang your coat on, others you could your soul. Stories to be lived by, stories as cautions, stories as seance, stories as witchcraft, stories as mass-inflicted healing, stories as full-on gambling with the fates, stories as seizures of truth-telling, stories as hypnosis, stories to outrun history, others to confirm it. And I've been absolutely loving that. And it ties back to actually something I'd written myself a couple of years ago in a piece called Season of the Wolf, where it's all about being primed by something rather dark and primeval.
I read Wolfaland, one of those books where it arrived and I read it virtually without pausing for breath. But what struck me was the real snarl to it as a book. You know, I mean, Martin's always been kind of unafraid to turn to what you might think of as his core audience down in Devon around sort of Totnes and Dartington and Schumacher College and so on, and you know, really direct a sort of uncompromising aside to the complacencies of New Age or activist culture or whatever. But there's a real kind of sense of not giving a fuck in this book that I don't think I'd seen before in quite the same way in him. And it's also, you know, it's a book about, I don't know if it's a book about, it's a climate change book that mentions climate change just at these few points within it. Mm. And weirdly, it feels like in doing that, it gets what it means to talk about climate change, or the you know, the difficulty of really talking about what we're talking about when we talk about climate change. In a way, very, very few of the books to do with climate change that I read feel down in their guts to me. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's something you said actually as well, that, you know, it almost comes from a place of disenchantment. You know, he's trying to re-enchant himself through this dark connection with place. But it, as you say, it comes from a snarl of disenchantment with the wider narratives that are currently being culturally told. And yeah, I mean, I think it's one of his most honest, raw and powerful books. And, you know, Martin is not an unhonest, unraw, unpowerful writer at the best of times.
Absolutely. Yeah. So listen, Ed, this state of alert, you've been mapping out some of the things that come into view when we start talking about, thinking about what those words can mean. So do you want to just like take us through a bit of that?
Yeah. So, I mean, apart from the old joke, be alert, your country needs lerts. I think we've been sort of wrestling through this. I always go back to the etymology of the word as a starting point. And alert actually is late 16th century, obviously originally from military use. It comes from the French alerte, or for the Italian alerta, which literally means to the watchtower. So when we start to think about this state of alert, we are literally heading to the watchtower. And it's about being quick to notice, you know, unusual and potentially dangerous or difficult circumstances and that state of vigilance. But it's also supposed to be about being able to think clearly and being intellectually active and being watchful for a state of possible danger. Now, this infects so much of our cultural understanding. You know, we've had it through terrorist alerts. You know, the Americans talk about DEFCON in terms of the state of alert towards nuclear Armageddon. Everyone understands the notion of red alert, that we might be there. And certainly here in the UK, we divide our state of alert in terms of security across three levels, you know, the sort of exceptional, heightened and normal. And that goes from everything where you expect a kind of attack to be happening imminently, i.e., you know, there is almost nothing that could be done to stop it, but we should be in a state of almost manic hypervigilance, to something which is supposed to be much more reassuring, just a very low late state of alert, if that's possible. But I think the thing that comes out of this understanding about states of alert is that high levels of constant alert are quite clearly and obviously fundamentally not only just unsustainable and untenable, but they're actually unbearable. They really do create a huge emotional and cognitive burden on us. And I came across this quote from the psychotherapist Susie Orbach, who said, "How the outside impacts on the inside is something that people like me think about all the time. But now we're seeing it on a grand scale. The pandemic has been a prolonged assault from outside on our community. And the state of uncertainty and unsafety it has created is new and utterly unfamiliar. Unless you are a refugee who has risked their life to get here, or a survivor of childhood abuse that could not be escaped, there is literally nothing to compare it to in your experience." And I just think that's incredibly powerful.
It's a very eloquent description of, I think, you know, what my impression would be is a pretty widely shared experience of the pandemic in a country like the UK. And listening to it, though, it also makes me think about what I've been noticing as we sort of head deeper into the time of COVID. Because the experience of the pandemic is quite different depending on where you find yourselves. You know, on the one hand, I live in Sweden and I work with people here. And on the other hand, I spend half of my life on calls with friends and collaborators in a dozen different countries, but especially in the UK and the US. And as the months go by, what I've been noticing is this widening gap between the state of mind of people in different countries, because I'm not sure that many people in Sweden would recognize their experience in that passage that you quoted from Susie Orbach. And there's a lot that can be said one way and another about how Sweden has responded. And there's been a huge amount of stuff written, and the pendulum sort of swings one way and then the other in terms of the verdict on Sweden being almost the only Western country which hasn't chosen a strong lockdown as part of its response to the pandemic. What I notice, whatever your analysis of how many people have died here and whatever mistakes you think have been made in terms of the policy this country has pursued. I can't avoid seeing that as the months go by, people here are just not as traumatized as people I speak to, certainly in the UK, but in many other countries. There isn't the pervasive sense of being under assault that Orbeck is describing, and that I definitely do hear reflected in lots of the conversations that I have with people elsewhere. And that's, you know, that's not a verdict on whether Sweden was right or wrong or lucky or disastrous in the approach that it's taken. It's just an observation about one aspect of how it's playing out at this stage, 6 months or so in.
Yeah, and maybe the difference between Sweden and the UK in that respect is the fact that it feels like the UK has been experiencing a background of constant alerts, you know, which I then think triggers a sort of alert response to anything else which comes across your bowels. And I think that's reflected actually in many of our ways of being. You know, even if we look at the world of social media with the push notifications and constant alerts, which are such a massive drag on our attention and our focus and productivity, because what people are doing is not multitasking. It's effectively task switching, which is the precise opposite of ruminative, reflective and expansive thinking, and a complete anathema to the flow we were talking about earlier. And I think that's sort of happening culturally at the moment right now. And when you consider the average business executive touches their phone 2,617 times a day, checks their emails 74 times a day, and receives 46 smartphone notifications a day. You know, if you start to just count that up, I like to think of it, you know, it's what, when people said, you know, I used to smoke 40 cigarettes a day. It's like, how did you find the time? You know, it's sort of 7 minutes a cigarette. That sounds like you're sort of constantly smoking all day. But it's likely the most executives never spend any time in flow at all, because every single immediacy and proximity heuristic imaginable is being constantly activated. And so I have a real concern about this perpetual state of alert.
It actually takes me back to something else that we discussed in the first series, because you brought in that extraordinary science fiction story, I think is the right word for it, from 1909, from the novelist E.M. Forster, The Machine Stops. And the sense that this was what the pandemic had brought, a sudden arrest to the machine of the global economy. And there's truth in that. And then there's also what's got clearer as the months go by, which is we've been sucked further into the machine than ever by this. And it's almost like two of the dynamics that we're seeing emerge as we move through those kind of early weeks of panic and crisis and things will be back to normal within 3 months and all the rest of it. As we move past that, like two of the things we're seeing, one is a flight into the machine and another one is a flight from the cities. And something extraordinary actually that's happening right now is the way that property prices are, you know, booming in the UK and in Sweden. If you think back a generation or so to the 80s and 90s, an economic crisis meant lots of people getting in trouble in the housing market. It meant soaring interest rates, people not being able to keep up repayments on their mortgages, and people losing their homes and house prices falling. But then you think about 2008 and the global financial crisis. I mean, sure, part of what triggered it was crazy lending in the subprime market in the US. But the fallout from that crisis, the political priority was to insulate the property owning classes against austerity, against economic hardship. And so it's like we've moved to a different reality to the one that our parents' generation lived in. And so now the response to massive economic crisis is, you know, load up on property. buy the biggest house on the biggest loan you can afford, because that's the one thing that they're not going to let go down. And I don't know whether that's, I don't know how long that holds for. Look, this is like a long way away from anything that's my field of knowledge or expertise or even much experience. But I just find it really, really striking. And last week or so, I had two conversations, one with a theologian in the UK who's very actively involved in the local community in her church in a part of London, and who is really troubled in a deep way by this, you know, flight into the machine and by how many people she knew were of the sort of, you know, of the property owning classes, I guess you'd say, were planning to move to smaller places with bigger houses, move to somewhere where you don't know anybody, do all of your work over a screen. And she was like, well, you know, this tradition that I come out of, incarnation and embodiment is so important. The experience of being physically together, breathing the same air, and of a community that cannot be just replaced by the things we're able to do over screens and cameras. And then a couple of days later, I was talking about that with a theatre maker who I was working with in Stockholm. And she said, well, okay, but what I'm seeing is people spending less time with the colleagues who we would have been face-to-face with, but more time face-to-face with our own community of the people who matter to us most. And yes, you know, we're talking about moving to a place we might not have been able to live before, and we had to commute in 5 days a week to the places that we were freelancing at or whatever. But yeah, she was like, I mean, I think there's a transition underway. And so maybe we begin to loosen our connection to the community of the people we happen to work with, and deepen our connection to the community of the people we find ourselves living alongside in a particular place. And that would certainly be the most hopeful reading of how all this is going to play out. But there's also huge, you know, disparities between what that looks like depending on your situation and, you know, however it plays out. I think what's clearer to me now than it was when we recorded the last episode of season one is just this real sense of living through great changes. You know, that James Altucher post that got a lot of attention, NYC is dead forever, here's why, where he's talking about, you know, having lived in New York through previous crises, through 9/11, through the 2008 financial crisis. And he says, this, you're never supposed to say it's different this time, he says, but it is.
Well, it was funny, if I was talking to a journo mate of mine the other night, and he said, I actually quite like London because it's not so hectic. I mean, with the caveat that obviously it has a devastating impact on businesses and arts organisations and other bodies that require audiences or footfall. But I mean, I think there's huge ramifications of this that are not being fully thought through quite yet. I mean, certainly to be working in commercial real estate right now, I think you would have to be nervous. With the understanding, as you already highlighted, that, you know, we see it with the kind of back to the office mantra that the government is obviously trying to lead a return, because these towers are still going up everywhere, and they are predicated on the fact that everyone will come back. But what struck me was the kind of complete unviability of a skyscraper because of actually the most humble elements to it. Because if you're trying to get thousands of staff into a 30 or 40 story building, your limiting factor is your lifts. You know, and these sort of express lifts that would have taken 20 people to the top of the building in seconds with physical distancing can only take one or two folk. And there's some fascinating stuff you can read online about the number crunching of the logistics of this, because as soon as you start to get a backlog, because obviously that's a tenth of the number of people you'd normally be able to get in the lift. And then under normal office hours means you'd have a queue of potentially hundreds of people trying to get into the building, which with physical distancing then becomes hundreds of meters, if not a kilometer or more long, and literally taking hours to get people in and out of the building. So, of course, you can stagger people's working days, but once you get everyone in, they're not going out for lunch.
So what you were saying, Ed, is skyscrapers are broken.
Well, kind of, yeah. I mean, as long as physical distancing is required, you know, you're only going to ever get a fraction of the workforce into them under any kind of semblance of normality, whatever that might mean. And so, yeah, I mean, apart from retrofitting massive additional numbers of lifts, which can't be easy in the core of a building, it's really going to be very, very tough indeed. And these will basically become, you know, offices as vertical prisons that people might go into once a week. But, you know, I do think there's a fundamental challenge here, which these are the quirky, unexpected questions which arise when you actually get down into the nitty gritty of what trying to get back to normal means.
Right. And there must be 100 other examples like that of where ways of doing things that we've just, you know, taken for granted are broken and not easily repairable for as long as we have to be adapting our behavior in response to this virus.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, and that's what brings us on to another thing about the state of alert, because one of the many sort of hyper arousal symptoms of PTSD, of post-traumatic stress disorder, is hypervigilance. You know, and this refers to this experience of being constantly tense and on guard because your brain is on high alert for perceived danger. And that state of increased awareness, anxiety, and sensitivity often manifests as a need to always scan your surroundings for potential threats. And that can lead to all sorts of aggressive behaviors in everyday situations. And I think we're actually seeing some of this culturally in terms of, you know, a lack of objectivity or people reading too much into specific situations, and over-awareness and sensitivity of what people see or think about us, looking for others to betray constantly, being constantly concerned about others, or not being aware of what is obvious to others. Now, some of that plays into that whole world of conspiracy and entrenchment and like binary polarized views that we touched on in series one. But above all else, it leads to a sort of sense of suspiciousness, paranoia, and catastrophizing, you know, which is fundamentally unhealthy. And I read something that was really relevant and resonant with this by a guy called David J. Morris, who wrote a book called The Evil Hours, A Biography of PTSD. And he was a war correspondent in Iraq. And when he returned to the US, he found when he tried to explain what he had seen and experienced in the war, someone always interrupted to deliver a cliche heard on TV, like, "It's all about oil." And the felt reality of war didn't interest them. And I think, you know, you can see this in some of the crises we're discussing now. I mean, there was a particularly shocking statistic that, you know, 49% of the UK population had no sense of concern about refugees crossing the channel. You know, that they were all just a bunch of freeloaders coming here to parasitize our way of life. And I think that's like a PTSD response in some way. And what David Morris realized, that people back home didn't understand what was happening in Iraq because they didn't want to understand. And in his words, he said, not only was it beyond their ken, but the fact that it might be beyond their ken was beyond their ken. So being on the other side of something that no one else understands, with a valley of misunderstanding between them, is a particularly uncomfortable and stressful place to be.
Okay, so there's something here that echoes across to the work around climate change, because there's a book by Carrie Norgaard called Living in Denial. And she's a sociologist who came from the US to Norway quite a while ago now, over 15 years ago, I think, to study responses to climate change. And she stayed in a small rural community on the west coast of Norway. And the year that she was staying there, there happened to be an unusually mild winter, to the point where the ski resort couldn't open until 2 months later than normal. Someone fell through the ice and drowned on the fjord. And so, you know, she said, in the newspapers, people were writing about the connection between global warming and what was happening. It was there in, you know, in the background of people's consciousness. And yet people seemed untouched by it. You know, you'd listen to a news report about the collapse of the climate negotiations in The Hague, and then get into the 4x4 and drive your kids down the hill to take them to school. And no one would seem to be organizing protests or writing letters to the newspaper or whatever. And the argument that she makes in her book is that this is a there's another kind of denial, which is not the thing we normally talk about when we're talking about climate denial, but which is actually kind of more pervasive and closer to home for many of us, which involves this sort of inability to connect the out there facts to anything that would change us or change our ways of living, our communities, our decisions. And there's a report that she wrote for the World Bank looking back on that research where she sums it up in one sentence. She says, in some sense, not wanting to know was connected to not knowing how to know. And I wrote about this last winter in one of the Notes from Underground essays for Bella Caledonia. And there I was putting what Norgaard says together with a passage from a British theatre maker, Chris Good, from a book called The Forest and the Field, Changing Theatre for a Changing World. And Chris writes, my sense is that only seldom is the problem that we don't know, or at any rate, that we don't know enough. The real problem is that we don't have a living space in which to fully know what we know, in which to confront that knowledge and respond to it emotionally without immediately becoming entrenched in a position of fear, denial, and hopelessness. So for me, when you talk about Morris's experience as a war correspondent returning home, and about the impact of binging on news, and the sort of coldness, the sort of shutdownness that's there in that reaction to, you know, people in desperate situations trying desperately to get to the UK across the channel in tiny boats, like, I think the connection is something like this. And more information, more news, more knowledge in the form of facts doesn't bring us closer to what we're talking about. It doesn't help us grasp it or make sense of it or become changed by it. It just exhausts us. And it leaves us in kind of a state of dissociation. It's like Amitav Ghosh, the novelist, says, they'll look back on this moment in human history and call it the great derangement. We were deranged out of our senses. We couldn't recognize what was actually going on.
I think that's bang on. And maybe it takes a novelist to see that, you know, because what you don't get from that sort of barrage of information is story in the big sense. So people are, you know, cherry picking or, you know, taking things in isolation to build their own narratives. I'm struck by a quote from the Danish author of Out of Africa, funnily enough, Isaac Dinesen, who said, all sorrows can be born if you put them in a story or tell a story about them. And there's actually another fascinating piece I stumbled upon, which was actually writing about the war of homecoming, a bit like David Morris experienced on the way back from Iraq, because actually you can get PTSD even in the aftermath or the readjustment to the aftermath. And the piece was exploring Homer's Odysseus and saying, after all of the challenges of the great voyage, actually some of the biggest trauma was having to come back in disguise and then battle once again for the love of your wife. It was actually almost the worst trauma was at the end. But then I turned to Tolkien, and there was a couple of quotes I came across which I think play to that power of narrative and the ability of a story to take us into the uncomfortable places in a way that doesn't lead to that state of dissociation and doesn't lead to perhaps the denial and rejection. And there's a line in Lord of the Rings saying, how do you pick up the threads of an old life? How do you go on when in your heart you begin to understand there is no going back? There are some things that time cannot mend, some hurts that go too deep, that have taken hold. So in one sense, that's about this sort of return. But then there's another line where Arwen is bestowing the even star to Frodo and says, when the memory of the fear and the darkness troubles you, this will bring you aid. And I do think, I mean, it's been a recurrent theme of the great humbling, but it is the ability of stories to help us sit with that uncomfortable truth, with that discomfort, and with those hard to acknowledge and absorb type of ideas and scenarios, because that's the only way I think we have a chance of being able to navigate or weave these threads together.
You know, maybe one of the tasks in dark times or living with a sense of darker times to come, is to find those things to hold on to, the things that still make sense when most things stop making sense, the things that still feel meaningful when most things feel meaningless. And they can be stories, beauty things, objects, fragments of words, memories. You know, if you read Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning, about his experiences in the concentration camps, so one of the things that stuck with me from that was just his testimony of those small things that continue to make a difference in the absolutely most horrific situation that you can imagine going through. So I guess, in a way, we're back to where we started at the outset of season one with the stories that are being wrapped around this pandemic. And it seems to me like 6 months in, there are two big stories in play. Either it's the story about returning to normal, getting back to business as usual in some form, or else it's the story about how we seize this moment and make the COVID-19 event into a turning point.
You know, what you're describing there is basically almost like a fight or flight type of response, where the fight is the build back better, the return to work, you know, the kind of we'll carry on as before, but with some modest changes, which will make things better, which is, as you say, sucking us back into the machine. And then on the flip side of that, you've got the flight response of this changes everything, you know, and this sort of slightly maniacal, right, go back to ground zero and change the way everything works, which is almost like a running away from something. And that state of alert can then take you in one of those two completely bifurcating directions.
So maybe there's something lacking in both of those. And what's lacking is a touch of humility. The thing that Takvalik Partridge is pointing to in that quote about this being the warning shots, I've been thinking about that phrase all summer, and it's come home to me in the past couple of weeks, actually, as we started gearing up for the new series. Because if this pandemic isn't the big event, if it's just one in a series of storms heading towards us, then on the one hand, it's not going to be the moment when everything changed. It's not that turning point. And on the other hand, it can't be about going back to business as usual, because business as usual is what's bringing on that chain of storms, these kind of semi-predictable crises into which we're headed. You know, that's what's business as usual is what's fueling those in the first place. And so I'm looking at it from here in Sweden, and I'm thinking, okay, let's say this society did get off lightly, that the comparative lack of restrictions has left people less traumatized and with less of that pervasive sense of fear, and that maybe this counts for a lot in terms of the longer term effects of the pandemic. But here's the thing, that's not a vindication of this society. Because it's not any kind of grounds for assuming that it will be well placed when the next storm hits, whatever direction that comes from. Because the factors that put one society straight in the path of this particular storm, while another society maybe gets off lightly, those might not be the same factors next time. So unless we're willing to look at this as the warning shots, my fear would be that we'll have one set of countries that are the most broken by COVID and the pandemic and the systemic fallout of that. And then we'll have another set of countries that are lulled into a kind of complacency, that don't recognize how far they have to fall because their story tells them that they got things right rather than just that they got lucky this time. And I guess that's what it means to me to talk about the great humbling, the sense that one way or another, the way things are headed, we're all going to be brought down to earth. And maybe it's time to to find ways of coming to terms with that.
Thank you for listening to The Great Humbling. We see this podcast as very much an exploration, not a prescription. A provisional investigation that maybe loves questions more than answers to begin with and needs a little time and space to breathe. If you are new to the podcast, please do revisit season one, as we are aiming to build on ideas, insights and narratives already touched upon. And together, this will hopefully enable us all to make a little more sense of these strange times we are living through. Please do comment, ask questions and respond via our Facebook page, The Great Humbling, or via my Twitter account, @frucall. And we would obviously deeply appreciate and be grateful for any ratings, reviews, recommendations or sharing you might feel compelled to contribute as a result of listening. Our title music is I Recall by Blue Dot Sessions, used gratefully under a Creative Commons license. We're living in a time of humbling, an initiation at a cultural scale. Please join us on this emergent journey.